The perfect combination of versatile athleisure and training apparel has arrived. Thanks to the visionary minds of New Balance, Clutch Athletics, and Rich Paul, the designs reflect the heart of the athlete and the spirit of the community. With rising defensive football stars Will Anderson and Chase Young on the roster, Clutch Athletics brings the best innovative gear to all athletes, giving them style and performance on and off the field. Learn more and purchase Clutch Athletics at NewBalance.com.
Welcome to the Cover 3 Podcast with your hosts, Chip Patterson and Barton Simmons. It's your call for the best college football coverage. From National Signing Day to the National Championship and everything in between, CBS Sports presents the Cover 3 Podcast.
And welcome back to the Cover 3 Podcast here on CBS Sports. That's Barton Simmons. I'm Chip Patterson. We've got Stephen Prather of Sports Source Analytics coming up in just a little bit. It is Coach Rankings Week, and while the rankings that Barton, myself, Tom Fornelli, who will be joining us to break down those rankings on Wednesday, and many others of the experts, you know, we had numbers at our hands and at our disposal, but for the most part, kind of felt like a lot of it was with the heart. Maybe as much as with the head, and it'll be nice to have some sobering conversations with Stephen. Barton, how are we feeling?
We're good. Coach Week's one of my favorite weeks because it's great. It's great conversation. It's great debate fodder, and I'm convinced that college football fans are ultimately soap opera fans at their heart. And
explain. I like they, this.
They. I think coaches take on this like character persona for college football fans, and that's why the coaching carousel is people are so ravenous for it, because what they're really looking for is just like storylines and following the characters, and I think they're more interested in that stuff than they are in like scheme and personnel. So ultimately, these college football programs have these faces that are representative of the program, and then you can talk about how they're evil, good, bad, spiteful, petty, whatever, and you can just like play out all these little, you know, telenovela type of drama if you want to.
I love that. Love that take. Well, as the actual rivalries get going on the field, we'll come up with some good character arcs.
That's right.
We got to see if we're going to be it's like we got to see if the character from USC makes it to the end of the season.
Yeah, the good guy.
Right.
The good guy that's just, you know,
down on his luck.
Keeps on getting knocked around, but everyone is really appreciative of his character. But he can't win a battle to save his life.
So we're recording here on Tuesday morning. The American Athletic Conference rankings 1 through 12, AAC only, is up on CBSSports.com. 65 through 26 of our Power 5 coaches rankings are going to be going up here shortly, and then we will reveal 25 through number 1 on the website CBSSports.com on Wednesday. Wednesday will also be when Barton, Tom Fornelli, and myself, we will bring our own ballots to the table for a little bit of conversation and debate, which should be a lot of fun. Few fan bases are more passionate about getting disrespected like UCF, and it's been years of it together. And our ranking of Josh Heupel not being number one was not good.
Oh, did CBS catch some heat? Did the CBS handle catch some heat?
No, Chip Patterson, the guy who had to write up.
Oh, because he wrote the story.
Yeah. And so that's like, you know, number one, it is a consensus ranking. I am but one ballot in this, but because my byline is on it, and because I did add some of my own comments to the ranking, Josh Heupel number 5, and I even started it with talk about a big swing and a miss by us. Our ranking of AAC coaches a year ago had Heupel then heading into his first year as head coach after being offensive coordinator at Missouri at next to last at number 11. So I'm admitting we were off having him number 11. But with him at number 5 and Ken Niumatalolo coming off a 3-10 season at number 1 still for the second year in a row, the UCF fans were not happy.
Yeah, I think I think that Heupel being 5 is the only thing that I think is not very defensible in that, and I don't know where you had it. I think it's hard to argue that Charlie Strong, and at this stage in his career, should be above Heupel. It's a little bit of door number 2. I mean, I guess Charlie Strong had a good first year. A little bit of like the mystery of Heupel. As I talk through it, no, I don't think there's any reason to be like furious. I mean, Heupel still is in year 1, or going into year 2. I personally had Heupel above South Florida and Charlie Strong. I think I maybe had him above Dana Holgorsen.
Right. I mean, what do you do with Dana Holgorsen? That's a big part of sorting out the top of the conference.
Right, because ultimately, and we'll dig into this a lot tomorrow when we talk about the Power 5 rankings, but to me, this isn't a Hall of Fame ballot. This isn't a career snapshot. This is who you are right now. And right now, even though Charlie Strong had some great years at Louisville, and I mean, good enough years at Louisville to be hired as the head coach at Texas, for goodness sakes. But right now, it's hard. I mean, it's been a while since Charlie Strong has looked like a great coach. And with that said as well, like, I had Luke Fickell, I may have even had him number 2 or 3. I think I had 3 right behind Norvell. Because that's hard for me to – I don't know where you had Fickell, but hard for me to see Fickell all the way down at 6 in our coach rankings.
I had him top half, I think. I mean, that was the other one that you had to make the big adjustment on. The year before, we had Fickell at 10. But then he goes from 4-8 to 11-2, knocks off Virginia Tech in the bowl game, won every single game at home. Like, that's Luke Fickell's got it going. And like, and I wrote this, and it was like, you know, my brain gets a little bit between college football, college basketball, golf. Like, it can get a little cluttered on the mental desk. But didn't Fickell start with a Cincinnati team that was hugely packed with freshmen and sophomores?
Well, are you saying that as a positive or a negative?
I'm saying that as it is one of those situations where, similar to what we saw with Dave Doran his first year at NC State, he had one of the youngest teams in the ACC, but then all of a sudden with steps forward, when he's going into year 3, he's got the same players. They have all this game experience. They've continued to develop, and now this is a large group of players that have struggled together and succeeded together. And then Cincinnati, now you got to look at them as like, man, is Cincinnati going to challenge UCF? I mean, are they about to go and contend for a conference title? Because I think that might be the case.
Yeah, but I think all of that is a credit to Fickell to me.
Oh, 100%. Right? Yeah. I mean, when I looked at the consensus rankings, I felt like there was a lot being given to Charlie Strong for what he did at Louisville.
And yeah, and a lot, and no question. And we've got some guys on the panel that I think have a little more traditionalist view of this approach to where they think of this in terms of, oh, Charlie Strong, like, this is, Look at all he's accomplished over the course of his career. What's Josh Heupel done, or what's Luke Fickell done? Right? I mean, they've been head coach for 3 years combined. But I don't look at it that way. I look at it. The way I look at it is, who would you want to coach your team
right now?
And if any of the people that put Charlie Strong above Josh Heupel and Luke Fickell would say, I would take Charlie Strong as my coach of my football team over those two guys, I'm not sure they would say that, for one, but for two, if they did, I would certainly disagree with them.
Let's see. I had Fickell number 4 and Strong number 5.
Yeah, that's better.
I did Norvell 1, Holgo 2, K Ken Niumatalolu 3, Fickell 4, Strong 5, Rod Carey 6. That was my top half.
Yeah.
And shout out to Rod Carey, by the way. He's going to get a real opportunity because he won a lot in Northern Illinois.
Yeah, sneaky good coach. Consensus 12, I would imagine. Randy Edsel, I can't imagine, was firing anybody up.
Mm-mm. You mean one of the most historically bad teams in the history of football?
The worst defense statistically in the history of the game. I mean,
good luck, Randy. I want to hit on this because it is another chapter in what is the biggest, if not second biggest, just sort of ongoing story in all of college football from a big picture standpoint, and that is the continued growth, evolution, and what I see as really being the final piece of a big time, like, level up moment for the Clemson Tigers. As they have in the last 2 weeks or so, we talked about Brian Breesy, number one defensive tackle. They're locking down the top two players from the state of Florida with DeMarcus Bowman. Is that right? The running back?
Yeah.
DeMarcus Bowman. And then in a much hyped, very, you know, celebratory moment for the program, they locked down five-star DJ Uiagalelei. You've been talking about him here on the podcast in a little bit. 24/7 Sports has identified him as one of the most unique quarterback prospects. 6'4", 240 pounds, just absolute cannon of an arm. He commits to the Clemson Tigers, chooses him over the Oregon Ducks, and now the post-Trevor Lawrence succession plan is in place. Clemson is going to be a real contender for the number one class in 2020. I would assume very much already locked up, basically, the best recruiting class in program history. And where Clemson previously was, it's like they were closing the gap with Alabama, Georgia, and Ohio State with player development and execution, right? Like, they were getting in really solid players, definitely some five stars in there. That goes all the way back to, like, Sammy Watkins. But they've been able to close the gap with player development and execution. Now they are also truly recruiting at the level of an Alabama, Georgia, or an Ohio State. And the future just looks scary if you consider what they've been able to do with the talent that they've had to this point.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, Clemson's formula boils down to a couple things. They get a couple of elite five-star level playmakers, typically out of Florida, a year. They've recruited the defensive line as well as anybody in the country, and they've recruited the quarterback position as well as anybody in the country. I mean, if you got those three things, it doesn't really matter that much what your offensive line is like or what your linebackers are like or what your DBs are like, really. I mean, so they're continuing to do that. They've got – I'm look like right now, if we assume DJ Uiagalelei is going to be a quality starter as good as we think he is, and I think the comp for him is Jamarcus Russell from a – Not from an off-the-field character standpoint, obviously, but from a tools, trait standpoint. I know that feels like a slight in these days, but remember, that guy was picked number one overall. So if he is that what we think he is, then we could be looking at 2023, maybe even 2024, before Clemson has a starting quarterback that wasn't the number one player in the country, or the number one quarterback in the country, at least coming out of high school. I mean, that's insane.
Yeah.
And so, and not only that, but they just lost three first round defensive linemen to the NFL draft. They've got at least three other five-star defensive linemen now stepping in to fill their shoes. And they've got the top three defensive tackles in the country, maybe four of the top five or something committed this cycle. They've now had four straight five-star commits, and they're going to have a fifth straight five-star commit later this month, another defensive lineman. This is a class that would make Alabama blush. Like, this is a class that is doing things right now. There's a long way to go, but there's no reason. Like Clemson, I don't think has had a decommitment for non-academic reasons in like 5 years. I mean, so it's not as if this is some house of cards that, oh, early recruiting rankings don't mean anything. No, no, this is a ridiculous class that is looking like it's pacing to be the best recruiting class of all time. So it's just that they have done what they've done with a five-star top of the rankings or top of the class, three stars that other Power Five schools didn't want, bottom of the class, and they build this roster and build this culture and they go win games. That's what they've been doing. Now they could potentially be building the same kind of culture with five stars up and down the recruiting class. I mean, where do they go from here? I mean, again, you can't find the weakness in like missing out on a quarterback right now. So where is the hole? And it's just scary to think what they're close to accomplishing or what's just in store, what just sort of is inevitable.
Well, and that's the, like, it, this does not matter. This is the kind of stuff that Dabo Swinney would call clutter and what college football coaches want to leave on the outside. But if our purpose is talking about the sport and, you know, diving into the storylines and the things that we find intriguing, it is the change from Clemson, the underdog, from Clemson beating on the door, Dabo Swinney sitting there on college game day screaming, saying, we've won as many games in the last 4 years as only three programs, Alabama, Oregon, and Ohio State. Why aren't we getting respect from having to overcome Clemsoning and everything else? It's like, now I think that with the second national championship and with what they're doing on the recruiting trail, it feels like we've hit over to the other side. Like we've gone to the upside down where Clemson is not the hunter, but the hunted, where the target is on their back, not just in the ACC, but nationally and in a very national way. Like, is Clemson fatigue coming? Like in the same way that people get sick of talking about Alabama all the time. Like I think that Clemson's going to start being, they are no longer going to be as lovable in the national conversation as they have been during this rise.
No doubt, especially because Dabo is as likable as he is and was as an underdog. He's going to be that annoying as the favorite and the hunted. I can already see it coming. And now Clemson, you know, hey, Clemson, get used to everyone accusing you of cheating.
Right.
Get used to, it's all of it is going to, they are a blue blood now.
Right.
The Roy bus is gone. The Roy bus is in the junkyard. You are no longer allowed to claim the Roy bus. You are the big dogs in college football, like it or not. And now everyone's going to enjoy hating them, I think. We may be like 1 year away. Like, they'll still be – Trevor, how can you – like, because Trevor Lawrence is such a likable guy. Like, they recruit a lot of likable guys.
Right.
That's sort of part of their charm. But, you know, another year of long-haired Trevor Lawrence balling out, if we're in year three, it's gonna get real old to a lot of people. And so I think this is the – transition year. By year three, they're straight up villains.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. How could this Clemson team with like Christian Wilkins and Deshaun Watson, like how could this Clemson program become a villain? But man, if they
like, when was the last Clemson player that could even play that role? Maybe Ben Bulwer, just because he was this sort of scrappy, you know, linebacker that was, you know, always making plays behind the line of scrimmage and celebrating. I don't know. Like, maybe you could play him up as a heel.
Well, because he was with Christian Wilkins, and Christian learned his lesson and stopped doing it when he got caught. But they were sticking their fingers where they shouldn't have been sticking them in the hole.
They got caught
for that.
That'll be regurgitated here in the coming years, I promise you. As like a montage of some fan theory of Clemson being dirty, you know. And now they got the They've got the Dexter Lawrence failed PED deal where, you know, there's South Carolina fans that I've heard being like, oh, Clemson's doping their players up because of that. It's like, it's all going to be on the table now with everyone just looking to pick reasons to hate that program. And it's not going to happen year. It's not going to happen this year. But I think 2020, everyone's just going to the avalanche of Clemson haters are going to start piling on.
All right. We will get to our conversation with Stephen Prather of Sports Source Analytics right after this.
Did you know that while over 60% of Americans dream of starting their own business, less than 20% of them take the first step? The reason? Building a business is tough. Taylor Brands is simplifying the business journey. From launching and managing to growing your business, Taylor Brands isn't just another tool. It's your online business partner from launch to success. With Taylor Brands, building your dream business becomes an effortless experience. Their comprehensive platform guides you through every step, ensuring you have everything you need in one place. From LLC formation to bookkeeping, invoicing to acquiring licenses and permits, and even setting up your bank account, Taylor Brands handles it all seamlessly. And our listeners will receive 35% off Taylor Brands LLC formation plans using our link, taylorbrands.com/CBS Sports. That's TAILORBRANDS.com/CBS Sports. So start your business journey today with Taylor Brands.
Robert Half research indicates 9 out of 10 hiring managers are having difficulty hiring. If you have open roles, chances are you're feeling this too. That's why you need Robert Half. Our specialized recruiting professionals engage with our proprietary AI to connect businesses of all sizes with highly skilled talent in finance and accounting, technology, marketing and creative, legal, and administrative and customer support. At Robert Half, we know talent. Visit roberthalf.com today.
And now it's our pleasure to welcome to the Cover 3 podcast, Stephen Prather of Sports Source Analytics. This is a conversation that we've been really looking forward to because it rolls right into the CBS Sports Coach Rankings that will be coming out a little bit later on this week. Sports Source Analytics is just an absolute boss. They are paired with all 5 Power 5 conferences, the ACC, Big 10, Big 12, SEC, Pac-12, and the American, the college football playoff. They've got relationships with athletic departments. They've got relationships with coaching staffs. Stephen, this is a 12-month, like some people who work in football, it can be seasonal. It seems like the work that y'all are doing, there is no off season. It is 12 months of the year.
No question. We, in fact, I usually find myself almost busier when it's technically the off season than during the actual season. This is really the next probably 90 days are our busiest time of the year.
What are y'all doing during that 90 days?
So, I mean, a lot of it is new business generation. So, you know, the good and the bad is, you know, we usually get involved in a fair amount of coaching searches, which is good. The bad is we also get a lot of shuffling around of coaching staffs, you know, not only head coaches, but all the coordinators and assistant coaches. So, you know, often we're scrambling around that we might have built a relationship with one guy here and now he's gone to a different school, then that almost restarts our sales cycle. So, And obviously, we're trying to get FaceTime a lot of these coaching staffs that we're trying to get in front of. So this can be a heavy travel season for us in trying to go visit with existing clients and then future clients. We also ramp up pretty heavily here as the summer gets in with some of the work we do with the playoff. That'll start to prepare, obviously, getting ready for the season. And then we're the off season is also where we get a lot of our new ideas and new platforms. Like We're about to be rolling out. We're really excited about this new salary projector that we're working on that would primarily be meant for athletic directors and also potential agents of really trying to project what salary should a coach be making. And then, you know, is he overpaid, underpaid? And it's been, we're using some really cool machine learning stuff we're getting into. And so we're in kind of testing mode for that right now. And we're pretty excited about the future of that. But that's the kind of stuff that we do in the off season. So it's really a really kind of heavy time for us.
Well, that sounds like a whole different podcast. Like, I feel like we can have a separate show on the salaries and coach value in and of itself. I really, you know, we're doing our coach rankings for CBS Sports. It rolls out this week. We'll talk about it on the podcast tomorrow. But I thought it'd be fun to get you on, because you kind of do some non-hypothetical work with coach evaluations, and obviously you do a lot of coach evaluation through analytics and data as well. I wanted to kind of open it up this way, you know, in the way you've and in your interactions with athletic departments, athletic directors, coaches, is there sort of a pet peeve, a common misconception, an overvalued sort of perspective on what makes a good coach, and how would you kind of, I guess, steer the conversation in terms of what you think kind of personifies the best coaches in college football?
Yeah, that's a great question, Martin. I mean, so it's been interesting to me. I'm just fascinated with, you know, what makes a good coach. You know, like why are some coaches better than others? And it's really been this interesting quest I've been on from the time when I played sports to, you know, I've always been really interested with leadership and with, you know, studying the guys that seem to separate themselves. And what's interesting is there's a little bit of, the more I get into it, the harder I realize the question is. In that there's not an easy answer, right? Oh, well, to be a great coach, you've got to be, you know, disciplined. Well, I mean, there's bad coaches that are disciplined coaches. Right. Well, to be a great coach, you've got to be, you know, an ultra relationship guy. Well, not necessarily. I mean, there's some coaches that don't, you know, have not developed deep relationships with guys. So it's really interesting. One of my biggest pet peeves from working a lot of times with the athletic director side is when these guys have this preset notion of what a good coach looks like. And it's often a little bit cliched, you know, it's the energy, you know, which I still don't have any clue what that is. Right. I mean, like, I don't, you know, we want a coach that's energetic. He has energy. I mean, I don't, does that mean like he's bouncing off the walls, or is it, I still don't have any clue what that means. I don't love it when people get stuck on these character traits that they have no idea if they actually correlate to winning or losing or being a good coach. And often the ironic part is, the coach they just fired oftentimes could have had a lot of the traits they say they're looking for. And that's for us where data starts, is helping you identify on the front end who the good coaches are. So, like, for, I always love the line, you know, Warren Buffett always says, you know, he would never buy a company or invest in a company if he didn't feel really good about the character and integrity of the leadership, right? So, I mean, obviously character and integrity matter, but back up. He doesn't even look at the company if they've got bad numbers, right? So, right. I mean, if it's not a company that meets his criteria on what he's looking for, he doesn't even get to the question of the character integrity. It's not like he's buying bad companies because the leaders have phenomenal character and integrity. He's finding the good companies and then separating those out and saying, okay, who's got good character integrity? So that's for us, is trying to identify, start with some of the number side and say, okay, who's actually performing well? Like, and who's done it consistently? And let's start with that. And then you can kind of get into, like, I would never tell you that characteristics don't matter, like their personality and some of that. It certainly matters, but I think it often gets overvalued.
What goes deeper than wins and losses when it comes to trying to collect the data? Like, what are some of the factors there beyond just scrolling to a coach's Wikipedia page and trying to see what all the data looks like laid out there?
Yeah, so we're big on, we kind of call it the three C's. Content is the first C, which obviously you've got to just have a lot of information. So, you know, for us, you want the wins and loss, right? But it goes so much deeper than that. We want to see detailed offensive performance, defensive performance, special teams, recruiting. And then once we have all that, we then have to give it the second C, which is context, right? So if we can't bring that into context, so we're real big on looking at performance. When we study a coach, I want to look at the several years before and see, okay, what did he take over? And where have they gotten better? Where have they gotten worse? You know, what are those areas? So we're real big on digging into the comparative part of a coach's performance. Like David Cutcliffe's a great example. I mean, Cutcliffe's barely won 50% of his games. Like, okay, well, that guy's not that great a coach. Yeah, but when you compare it to what he took over, and certainly look at his last several years, it's unbelievable what he's done. You know, whereas Frank Solich won, nearly 80% of his games and got fired because comparatively they were winning 95% of their games before. Mm. So for us, it's vital to get to the content, then the context, and then that can help you actually draw a conclusion but you've got to have the content and the context first. So for us, when we're evaluating, you know, it's not just wins and losses, right? Because you can look at a guy and say, this guy's won, you know, 75% of his games. But like I said, if he took over a program winning 95, well, then that's not good. Like, the guy's taking the program in the wrong direction. So, I mean, that's, we love to dig into that side of it. And we've got a really cool comparative analysis tool that allows us to really look at, there's, you know, 80 different statistical categories and see, you know, how much better or worse a program, you know, was under a coach compared to what he took over.
So I think the other thing that is tough when you're evaluating coaches, and this factors in and talking about some of the new coaches who are coming from coordinator positions where you don't really have win-loss records to point to, but yeah. Also when building out staffs, like I'm just convinced that there's a lot of bad football coaches in college football and in the NFL. And you talk to other coaches and they'll agree with you on that. But they keep getting hired. And so it really is, it feels like it's impossible to really tell who's a good coach and who's not, and from the assistant ranks, unless you've really talked to like a lot of people that have either coached with them or played for them, or maybe not. I don't know where you come in on this, but I'm curious, like, have you found some effective ways to evaluate assistant coaches and project those guys out?
Yeah, so I mean, you're exactly right, Martin. It gets really difficult. I mean, one thing that we've seen, one thing that's kind of amazed me is, and we've actually gotten into where we do work with some head coaches on coordinator searches. I'm often amazed at actually how little coaches know about other coaches. I mean, I've had circumstances where I've mentioned an offensive or defensive coordinator name when talking to a coach, and you would be convinced that there's no way this coach hadn't heard of the guy and they've not heard of him. Like, they didn't know what I was talking about.
Wow.
So there's definitely a familiarity bias with, you know, coaches. I get it. They get these small windows when they've got to make hires. And often what they do is they revert to who they know, right? So they go in their network and they get it. And the whole idea of, well, I've got to be able to trust them. Well, I mean, yeah, right? I mean, to some extent, but if they're a crappy coach, does the trust really matter? Like, right. I mean, if they get you fired because they're a crappy coach, it is difficult when you look at that. I mean, especially on the coordinator side, and what's gotten harder in this day and age is there's so many guys with the coordinator title, right? So it's like, there's the offensive coordinator, then there's the pass game coordinator and the run game coordinator and the co-offensive coordinator. So one of the challenges we've had recently is trying to dig into that and find out, okay, who's actually doing, like, how do we dig deep? And that's, there's no easy answer to that, because, you know, you could have two guys and then, they split the play calling duties. Well, I don't really believe that. So then you got to try to dig deeper. And then there's what side of the ball the head coach is involved in. So one of the things we try to also do is kind of do, you know, postmortems per se when coaching hires, especially at the coordinator level, when coordinators do get hired, we really like to track the success or failure and then try to go back and see, okay, what are there some conclusions that we can kind of get to based on this guy succeeded, this guy didn't, and what can we look back at and see? And it obviously gets difficult. And we always tell athletic directors we work with, this is not a science, right? I mean, this is difficult. Like, finding great coaches, if it was easy, it'd be a lot easier, right? It's not easy to do it. We certainly have looked at guys before, and I'm like, man, that guy did a lot better than I thought, or this guy did a lot worse than I thought. So it's not an easy thing, but I'll say this. I can't even imagine trying to do it without data. I mean, the amount of data we have is shocking, and it's still very difficult to analyze, you know, the coaches and how successful they're going to be or how they're going to transition, you know, to a different job.
Are there ever any times where you're tracking coordinators or assistants, you know, through their careers, and, you know, you maybe wonder why hasn't this coordinator or assistant been hired? And is there some benchmark where, you know, there's a lot of lifers out there in the coaching industry that are just assistant lifers? And is there, you know, when do you surpass that point where, if you haven't been tapped for a head coaching job, maybe as an assistant coach, you just kind of realize and you put in your own career planning that this is what it's going to be from here on out?
Yeah, you know, that is fascinating. Like, kind of like the Bud Foster effect, right?
Right.
You look at the guy who's been a defensive coordinator for about as long as I've been alive, you know, and did the same job. And you know, some of it, I think, is some guys clearly recognize. I think the tough part's been over the last 15 years, just the sheer amount of money that can be made as a head coach has probably forced a lot of guys that honestly were probably more meant to be career coordinators into roles where they chase the money, right?
Interesting.
It's hard not to.
Yeah. I
mean, you know, if you're making $500,000 and you can take a job, you're making $3 million. I mean, that delta is too much there to say, well, I'm maybe just a career coordinator. Now, I do think with the increase in coordinator pay, well, like it's hard to imagine that Brent Venables has not been a head coach, right? When you look at the success of Clemson and all they've done. But at the same time, you also look at what the guy's making. If you watch him coach, he loves to coach defense, right? I mean, you watch him on the field. That guy, I'm not saying he's not going to be head coach, but he clearly really likes being a defensive coordinator. And then he's getting paid really, really well to do it. He's got a great working environment. So I think you might see it to where guys now say, hey, you know what? I think I'm pretty content with making $2 million a year. And, you know, having this and not having to do the stuff a head coach does. But yeah, I mean, there are guys like you know, there's like Bud Foster, you know, Don Brown's a guy that comes up that's obviously been a long time. You know, some of these guys just more meant to be, you know, defensive coordinators and just accept that role. And I think you're seeing some of those guys are okay with that.
Brent Venables is an interesting one. I don't know Brent Venables, but everyone that I've talked to that has sort of knows him or has – more personal interaction with them says the guy's just the coordinator all the way. Like he just doesn't have a head coach personality, persona. And so it may be just this perfect situation where Dabo has this dream defensive coordinator working under him who they're able to pay well, who doesn't maybe even really want to go be a head coach and probably understands that he's best suited for a defensive coordinator.
That's right. But the money these guys can make now, it's like at some point these guys really need to ask themselves, you know, the thing about Venables, like at this point, he'd have to get a pretty major head job to get a raise, right? You know, I mean, the money he's making. And what, you know, it's like, does he want to go take the Kansas job and have that headache? Or does he want to make $2 million a year being the coordinator at Clemson and compete for titles and do what he loves to do?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And now he's got a son on the team, and he's got another son who's a senior in high school this year. And feels like he's got another 4 years there at least. In terms of like specific coaches, like are there this past hiring cycle wasn't quite as volatile as the previous one. Are there any coaching hires that you saw this past cycle that really caught your attention? And where you said, wow, you know, that's the guy I would have taken, you know, or that's a really underrated hire or one that's not getting as much hype as maybe it should.
Yeah. So I'm a huge Satterfield guy. I you know, he's a guy that we started tracking 3-4 years ago. And I'm just, The interesting part with Satterfield, the risk with a guy like Satterfield is that he's basically spent the bulk of his career both playing and coaching at one spot. And in a spot that's had a history of obviously success. That being said, I mean, I just loved the way they played football. And one of the things we've looked at recently, and I think there's a new trend, you know, the trend 4 or 5 years ago is just hotshot offensive coaches and coordinators just are going to get the jobs. And as the defenses have kind of caught up, I think you're saying, okay, who are the coaches that are really playing complementary football? Like who's actually performing well in all three phases of the game, that's recruiting well, that's developing well, that's playing good offense, defense, and special teams? And Satterfield's a guy that really jumped out at us at that group of five level and what he was doing. And what's great about a league like the Sun Belt is there's a lot of parity in that league, right? I mean, it's not like Satterfield was rolling out and his players were just head and shoulders better than everyone he played. And so he really had to coach his way to the success he had. And so he's a guy I'm really high on. I love Neil Brown. I'm really fascinated to see Neil at West Virginia. And I think Neil's an interesting one that kind of went from a guy that was on that kind of hot shot offensive coordinator route and really pivoted when he became a head coach and said, okay, we've got to learn to play complementary football. He puts a ton of emphasis on special teams. Their defense was phenomenal. And he went away from kind of the Kingsbury model of like, we're just going to try to score 60 points a game. You know, and if we lose 65 to 60, so what? Neil went to the approach of we're going to play complementary football. And my goal isn't to score points, is to win games.
Mm. So I love complimentary.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I think that's a great. So, because I've talked to you before, and you've been, you've been very much a believer in complimentary football. And so, you know, I think so many, like Cliff Kingsbury sitting here, the head coach of the Arizona Cardinals right now, because he put up 100 points a game, but they couldn't win. And so,
that's right.
Like, I think you make a great point that if you're the head football coach, and it doesn't matter if you're calling the plays or you're the offensive coordinator or not, but if you're the head football coach, your job is to figure out ways to win the football game, right? Like, you should be figuring out ways to help whatever part of your team needs that help, rather than just sort of putting the pedal to the metal to you, whatever that's your strength might be.
Yeah, so that's exactly right. Like I said, I think Bart, I may have talked about this at a lunch one time, but I mean, I got this from a book called Guts and Genius. Bob Glauber read a great book. He looked at Walsh, Parcells, and Gibbs. And Parcells' mentor was his high school basketball coach, Mickey Corcoran. And he said Mickey taught him, there's always a way to win games. It's a coach's job to figure it out. So we tell all these, don't look for CEOs, look for CFOs, chief figure outers. and you look at the greatest coaches, that's what they do. Like, look at Belichick. He's the greatest CFO of all time, right? I mean, nobody has been able to figure out. And that's a coach's job. Your job isn't to practice well or to recruit well or to, you know, have a great weight room program. Like, those are all, you got to do that, right? But at some point, it comes down to on Saturday or Sunday, am I giving my team a chance to win the game? Am I figuring out what I have to do? I think brains is massively undervalued. I say this a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but not really. If I was an AD or an NFL GM, I legitimately would give an IQ test to coaches I was considering. I'm dead serious. I really believe football is chess. It legitimately is a chess match. And I get it. It's played by people that are – it's very violent chess, right? But you look at the strategic moves and the decisions that have to get made, you can't tell me that brains aren't going to matter. Now, college football allows for a little bit less of brains because if I can just get bigger pieces, that's an advantage I can have.
Right.
But at the same time, you're never going to consist. So you can't tell me Nick Saban – is not a very smart individual. I mean, I know he is. I mean, I know the guy's extremely intelligent. He's very well read. So, I mean, I do think when it comes down to it, there's a part of that figuring out how to win. And figuring out how to win sometimes is, yeah, we may not need to score a lot of points in this game because that's not the way we're going to win the game.
In the context of a season, when you say chief figure outer, I go right back to your example of tracking Satterfield. The first year that App State made the transition, they were not eligible for a bowl game, but they started out the year like 1-5 or something. And Satterfield had to get everybody together, and they had to figure out how to turn that thing around. They won their last 6 games of the season that year and then went back-to-back double-digit win seasons after that in 15 and 16.
Yeah. I mean, and well, it's cool. Yeah, I probably watched a lot more App State football than the average person just because when we kind of get interested in the coach, we kind of pay attention. And I just love the way that they plan to win. I mean, I still say the greatest college CFO, in my opinion, is Bill Snyder. Mm. I mean, literally a guy goes to a place that like no one had even pretended to figure out how to do anything but massively lose. And he figured out how to not only not lose, but to win like big. And he did it with like all of a sudden he got, you know, 5-star players rolling in. And he did tap into the JUCO market, did a great job with that. But he is a fascinating study and the figuring out. And what was great about Snyder, I've talked to Michael Lombardi a lot about this, and he says, he looks at Belichick, coaches have to find a way to be divergent. I mean, you don't just like take on the trend and say, okay, well, everyone's running tempo, so we're going to do that. And Snyder, to me, was one of the great examples of a coach that figured out how to diverge. He was literally on the cutting edge. Urban Meyer will tell you that a lot of his spread principles came from studying Bill Snyder. Bill Snyder was on the front end of that spread, and he's certainly on the front end. Obviously, the Wildcat is called the Wildcat after Kansas State Wildcats. And then, honestly, when the rest of the league started catching up, he did a 180. It went back to almost single-wing football. I mean, he was going time of possession, single-wing kind of football with Colin Klein. So that's a guy that figured out each year, how am I going to win games and give my players the opportunity? That, to me, is what real coaching is.
That's going to be fascinating to see who effectively goes against the grain, you know, with, because like right now,
yeah,
I mean, there's the, you know, the Lincoln Rileys and even Alabama is sort of, you know, playing with this spread principle, and even it's trickled up to the NFL. And I'm not saying that's some sort of like fad, but at the same time, like, I'm curious. I mean, I look at Tennessee and Jeremy Pruitt, you talk about some sort of people that have to be smart. Jeremy Pruitt, I'm convinced, puts on this like act that he's this old, yeah, dumb country guy that doesn't know any better, but just play downhill. But I think he is. I think he is really actually very smart. And yet I think this like very stubborn old school approach, I'm wondering if this is going to play to where he's stuck in the past and the offense is going to be evolved enough, or this is going to be exactly what you're talking about, and it's going to be divergent to what everyone else is doing, and it's going to cycle back around to what to that's the different style, and they've got the different program that makes them tougher to defend or tougher to play against week in, week out.
That's right. Like, right. So that's why it's you know, the fascinating part, I wish I could remember, we tweeted it out maybe a couple weeks ago. So we looked back like 4 or 5 years back, and it's amazing. Like, almost so much of the tempo used to literally, tempo and spread used to literally be an advantage just in and of itself. It was like, if you just did it, it immediately gave you some advantage. The teams that really sold out on it, that were running a boatload of plays and really spreading the field. And you look back, and most of the teams that were that ran the most plays in the fastest amount of plays at, you know, the time, like almost all of them were above 500 and won. Interestingly, you look in the last couple of years, it's flipped. And not only are those teams not winning a lot, but they're actually losing a lot. And so a lot of the advantages of being a spread team just for the sake of like being spread and going fast are gone. So now what's going to be fascinating is seeing, okay, who can either just out-execute, or, you know, who's going to find a way to diverge within, you know, and have the next innovation. I mean, that's what's so fascinating to me about, like, the Patriots and Belichick. They were in two-back personnel. They were in 20 or 21 personnel. No, sorry, they were in 20 or 21 personnel this year over 50% of the time. And you know, but next year, who knows, they might go to be in an 11 personnel team back heavy. So it's interesting each year, you know, what is somebody going to do to be divergent? It gets really tough at the college level because obviously you're not professional. You don't have professional players. You've got a whole new team virtually every year and so many different guys. And I think the coaches that are really going to be the guys that are innovative are going to be able to, you know, how can you be simple yet still be sophisticated and have a game plan type of offense?
You've got relationships with dozens of different coaching staffs across FBS. What are some of the questions or concerns that you're hearing from the coaches in terms of how they can use the data or what they're looking to gain in terms of an edge?
Yeah, I mean, it's that. I mean, partly it's how do I not get swamped in data, right? Like I'll say this: there's not a data collection problem. And really, I mean, college football teams collect an enormous amount of information. The trouble is getting to what matters. And so that's the interesting part, the challenge they have. There's so much new stuff. You got all the catapult type stuff now, which is, I think there's going to be some cool stuff, but there's just reams of data that gets put out and all the stuff you're tracking. And these guys spend an unbelievable amount of time with their staff on tracking all this stuff. But it's the important part is actually understanding what matters. And that's what we really focus, is trying to help these guys say, okay, it's not what you're collecting, it's what really matters to you winning and losing, and how can we help get to that, to where it's not that you're wanting to look at 80 things, you're wanting to look at the 10 things that really matter. And a lot of times, coaches, something else, they get to this, well, we've always done it this way. We've always done it. Okay, we track it. You know, I love coming in and asking coaches, okay, let's look at your goal board, each game goal board. And, like, and just see, does the stuff actually matter to winning and losing, right? I mean, a lot of times they're tracking stuff that doesn't even matter.
What's an example of something that would be tracked that doesn't even matter?
So I'll give a concrete example. This was an SEC offensive coordinator, and we were going over goals, and he had a red zone scoring goal of 85. It was like 85-90% touchdown rate. So for the first thing we do is say, okay, is that even a realistic goal, right? I mean, you know, partly is like you need to make sure the goal has context.
Yeah.
And the goal was not realistic for this team in question. But then two, the problem with the red zone goal, and I told the guy was, I said, if you look at it, let's say we go to the end of the year and I said, Coach, you scored touchdowns 100% of the times you went to the red zone, but you averaged 1.5 trips to the red zone per game. Would you be happy? He's obviously like, well, no. I was like, well, then why is that a goal? Right? Let's say we got beat 52-7 and we got to the red zone one trip and scored a touchdown. Check, we made our goal. So, like when it comes to red zone, the trips is actually more important than your scoring efficiency. I mean, scoring efficiency is important, but only tied with trips to the red zone. So, like, there's a good example. Like, third down, I think third down goals can be overrated. You know, that coaches will set third down goals, and you know, we're real big on, and Michael Lombardi calls this, you know, Canadian League football, we call it the Walsh ranking. But how often are you getting first downs on first or second down? Because if you're relying on, you know, third down, I mean, you know, the best team might convert a little north of 50% in a season on third down. I mean, the best offenses have to be designed to move the chains on first and second down, and the numbers back that up. So we've seen coaches that overemphasize third down efficiency when I think they should be looking harder at first down efficiency, at P&10 efficiency, and things like that.
Just pulled this up, by the way, guys, as you were mentioning it. The best touchdown percentage red zone in the country last year was UCF at 79%. And to double down on your point, Stephen, Navy, which won 3 games last year, is number 5 in red zone touchdown percentage, below the rest of the group.
Who else is in there?
It was UCF, Miami, Ohio, Houston, Washington State, and Navy is the top 5.
Yeah. So, obviously, the idea is that, yeah, if you're only going to get there once or twice, you want to be efficient. But at the same time, once again, going back to the goal of winning, you know, I need to be getting there a lot. It is amazing. I forget the numbers offhand, but when you win the red zone trip battle, I mean, you just get to the red zone more often. I think you win 80% of the time. I may be a little bit off on that without having to look it back up. It's really high. Forget what your efficiency is. Just simply getting to the red zone more often. So that's the kind of stuff, like, we call it the first. We look at first down of P&10 efficiency, first down efficiency, winning the first half. Sorry, winning the first quarter, winning the first half, and scoring first. Those 5 firsts are – it is amazing in college football. Teams win over 70% of the times when they score first.
Wow.
You think about that. You win more than 7 out of 10 times. The numbers when you win after the leading – like Urban Meyer, I think, won 90-something percent of his games, and he was leading after the first quarter. Bill Snyder had phenomenal numbers on that. So there's stuff like that that we get really – and that matters because it matters on how you game plan. How important is it to score first? It's very important, and that needs to be understood by your coaching staff and your team.
I think the other thing that I've noticed that you've been emphasizing lately, and we've discussed this before too, but is the – what is it? The final 4 minutes and the first 4 minutes? Final 4 minutes of the first half, first four minutes of the second half?
Yeah, those middle 8 minutes, it's really interesting. And that's been fun digging into that. And that data is really fascinating on, like, how important. You know, I mean, Clemson was just, like, far and away the best middle 8 team in the country this year.
Yeah, I mean, think about the Cotton Bowl. I mean, the Cotton Bowl was, like, you know, that was a close game. and then middle eight, yeah, and then the game over.
That's right. Well, and that's where it's really fascinating, because when you look at, and that's important, because I think when you get the ball and you understand, especially the sense where you deferred, I mean, if you get the ball and there's 3.5 minutes left and you eat that clock and roll down and score a touchdown, and then you get that ball back and you march down this first one to score. I mean, you think about how much that flips a game. And, you know, this goes back, I mean, this is another Belichick. You know, Belichick kind of got real big on the middle eight as a way to try to defeat Peyton Manning. Because he did the single best thing he could do was just keep Manning off the field. And he looked at if he could kind of get that ball and control those last 4 minutes of the first half, go to a timeout, I mean, go to halftime, and then, you know, obviously have the ball coming out of halftime, he could keep Peyton off the field for like an hour of actual, you know, real time. You know, and he's like, that's the best way to stop a guy like that, you know, make him spend an hour without the ball.
Hmm. You mentioned Urban Meyer earlier. I was just, you know, either from your work with the data, your work with tracking coaches, what are your expectations for Ryan Day as he takes over the Buckeyes?
It's been tough. You know, I think Urban Meyer is one of the top, you know, certainly top 10 coaches in the last 50 years, if not top five, when you look at a guy that literally won everywhere he went in a big, big way. I think he was a true complimentary coach. I mean, he understood special teams, offense, defense, recruiting, player development. I mean, you know, Urban was really a phenomenal, phenomenal coach. Ryan Day's rolled into a tough spot, right? I mean, you're following a legend. You're at a program that expects to compete for national title now, and you've never been a head coach. And really, you know, you look at Day, you know, he's been under some good coaches, but I mean, I think I'm going to be really interested. I think it's going to be a tough, tough situation. I mean, I have heard really good things about him from people in the coaching world. But, you know, at the same time, you know, like it's hard to be prepared to jump into that situation. And I'll be very interested to see how he handles, you know, that role. I mean, it's going to be tough to you know, do what Urban did at Ohio State, in my opinion.
Across the rest of the coaching landscape, I'm just curious. I won't put you on the spot because I don't really know what your opinions are of these guys, but I'm going to throw a couple names at you. And if any of – because these are sort of – as again, we were asked to literally list 1 through 65, rank the coaches across college football. Yeah. And so there were some – I'm going to throw a couple names that were some of the maybe tougher ones for me to rank.
Yeah,
and you can take any one of them and go anywhere you want with them. One is Gus Malzahn. One is Willie Taggart. One is Will Muschamp. And then I'll give you one more. Steve Adazio. What do any of those jump out at you as sort of coaches that you have a strong opinion on one way or the other, or just sort of perspective on?
Yeah, those are actually a fascinating list. If you probably said name the five or six coaches that are the toughest to say, are they actually what kind of coaches are they doing a good job? Are they not? Like, I would literally probably say Muschamp fascinates me because you hear. I mean, I've talked to people that, you know, say, I mean, the guy clearly knows football. I mean, he's been around some of the best minds in football. At the same time, I mean, you look at his record and where he's been. I mean, it's you know, it's not great, right? So he's a guy that I think has struggled to develop into that truly complimentary coach of how can I go beyond just being this kind of intense defensive coach to being, you know, to being a head coach who's figuring out week in, week out how to win games, how to design game plans to win games. And I think that's the biggest trouble he's had is getting out of that role that you're no longer a defensive coordinator. It's tough because I've had debates with guys on this. I don't think you can successfully do your job the way you're paid to do it when you're an emotional roller coaster on the sideline as the head coach. I kind of joke that you need to have you need to outsource some of your emotions to your assistants. Like you might have a guy that when it comes time, if you need to rage, kind of a guy you can tap on your shoulder and be like, okay, rage for me for a minute. Go there and rage for me. But because you can't do that. There's too much at stake on thinking. And so that's why I look at Muschamp. The struggle I have with Will there's some games he finishes the game, he's sweating more than the players. I really do. I like Coach Muschamp. I think there's a lot of things he does. I think he knows the game. I think what's going to be interesting is, can he get to that next level of being a better CFO? And, yeah. You know, I think some of those other guys you mentioned, like Taggart's a fascinating one to me, because, like, on one hand, like, he did a phenomenal job at West Kentucky, taking that program from FCS, transitioning it and getting there. And he did it kind of with that, you know, a lot of that Harbaugh model. Goes to, you know, to South Florida, looks like he's going to be like, oh, I'm already, like, he looked like a home run hire. Horrible first, I think, 2 years at least. I give him a lot of credit. He kind of reinvented himself, brought in some of those modern principles. And then he's kind of, then he obviously transitioned to the Oregon job. The tough part of a guy like Taggart is, like, you've never seen him at a place long enough to see, can the consistency be there, right? Right. And so, if you ask me, like, I'm still up in the air on Taggart, too. It's like, okay, well, you've done some good things, but you've never been long enough for me to see if it's, because I think the hardest thing about being a good coach is consistency. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Saban, I think, Saban said, if consistency was a place, not many people would live there, right? So, like, it's really hard to consistently win over a long period of time when you've got to reinvent. I think that's where Gus has been, is, like, Gus was such on the cutting edge, right, of the tempo, the no huddle, the spread, the kind of power run spread that he brought in. Now everything's caught up. So now it's like, now what? Now what am I? Am I a play caller? Am I the mad scientist play caller? Do I roll into the CEO role? So I think that's where Gus has kind of struggled with trying to figure out, what do I want to be as a head coach? There's a little bit of an identity crisis he's had in that. And I think he's got to decide what he wants to be. And he's also got to decide, what's the next wave of innovation? I mean, do you need to re-innovate, or do you just double down on who you are and just out-execute people with what you're doing?
You didn't mention Adazio in there, because I let my emotions get in, because that guy knows football. That guy's a good football coach. And I probably give him credit that results on the field may not back up.
So no, but here's the problem with Adazio. If you look at it, Boston College it has a pretty decent little football history.
Right.
But it's a really tough place to win at. I mean, if you look at their budget, if you look at their recruiting base, if you look at a lot of that, like, that's, and obviously if you look at what's going on in the ACC, I mean, it's certainly a much better league than it was a decade ago. No question about that. So the fact that the guy's winning more than he's losing, here's the trouble he has. I'm telling you right now, fan bases hate 7-6 consistency. They hate it. Yeah. Even if it's okay, you'd be better off, like, popping a 10 and then a 2, and right, then a 7, then a 4, then an 11. And then, like, it's almost like it's like consistency. I think he's been very consistent, which, and honestly, at a place that's not easy to win, has done some really nice things. But the problem is, the fan base is like, well, damn, I'm tired of going 7-6.
I know.
Well, and you know, so that's like, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, I mean, obviously he's a 7-6 coach, or at least he's a 7-6 coach at BC. But if you're a 7-6 coach, like, where does that put you in the national landscape? I don't even know. Like, does that put you toward the bottom, or does that put you towards the top? Like, it's hard to even say, because most coaches aren't one place long enough at 7-6 to really get a feel for, like, where that puts you in the pecking order.
That's exactly right.
So, but we've kept you a lot longer than we told you we would, but I got one more question and then we'll let you go. I'll give you a chance to sort of, let's say I'm an AD or, you know, I'm looking for my next head coach. Are there a couple, and you can go coordinator, you can go group of five, but who are the guys you've got your eye on that aren't on the Power Five level yet that you think, you know, you've sort of identified as some guys you really are pretty bullish on in terms of their trajectory as a football coach?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, because what's so fascinating, when we've talked a lot about this just internally with our own team, is like trying to look at, you know, so many coordinators got hired, and a lot of those guys are now head coaches and play callers, on trying to kind of figure out, you know, who are the next like coordinators, you know, that are going to be, and also that so much the focus had been on offensive coordinators. And I think you're seeing some defensive guys. I mean, I know Barton, you and I are both, you know, I'm a huge Bob Shoop fan.
Yeah.
I think he's an amazingly intelligent guy. He's a phenomenal coach. I mean, you know, if you look at what he did at Vanderbilt, and obviously we saw him in action this year, and I mean, the Tennessee stuff, that's just kind of got its own. I mean, I actually think he did a good job there, and some of the circumstances are considered. I mean, I'm a huge, you know, Bob Shoop fan when it comes to that side of things.
Yeah.
You know, looking at the kind of up and coming coaches, you know, is interesting. I mean, I'm keeping a real close eye on Jason Candle.
Yeah.
You know, I'm very interested to see. Once again, you have a little bit of the, like, he's obviously spent the bulk of his career at one spot, but I think they play really good complementary football. I mean, he's a guy I'm keeping a real close eye on. Trying to roll through some of the guys here that we. I mean, it's hard not to be paying attention to Bill Clark at UAB.
Sure,
right.
And what he's doing. I mean, I really like the way that they play football. I love what they're doing. I mean, look, at some point, and it's going to have to be the right fit, and I actually thought Kansas would have been a phenomenal fit. Jeff Monken can coach.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, a lot of these Power 5 teams do not want to run the triple option, and I get that. And I actually would not advise the triple option for a lot of Power 5 teams. But for the right one, like, that guy can flat coach, and he's a guy somebody is going to need to take a chance on at that level. Big on Seth Luttrell. I like what Luttrell's done. I think Luttrell's kind of following in that Neil Brown that is still an offensive guy that knows how to put up points, but is also trying to design the team to be complementary, and that he's not just forgetting about defense, and he wants to play good defense, and they play great special teams. I still am interested. He got ignored last year, and they had a down year. There's still a lot of things I like about Mike Bobo. I think this is a really, really key year for him to kind of get back on track and kind of have that year. I mean, he's a guy I'm still paying attention to. You know, he's got a good pedigree.
Good coaches really can have bad years, and bad coaches can have good years, right, Steven?
That's right. That's right. We talk about it all the time. You know, it's not like you have a bad year and you should be just taken off the radar. So, I mean, there's kind of these other guys that, we were able to work on the Charlotte search. I'm really fascinated to see Healy in action, you know, at UNC Charlotte, kind of him taking that next step. I mean, that's a tough program, and that'll be an interesting job to see him in action. So, at the coordinator level, I'm trying to think here. I'm sorry, I'm kind of trying to pull up some names when we're talking here.
Well, we're putting you on the spot, so.
No, and that's fine. I'm just, you know, like at some point, you know, one of those Clemson guys or both are going to need to get some looks, you know, with Tony and Jeff Scott. My understanding is obviously Elliott's a play caller. I'd like to see him get a shot, you know, see kind of him in action. Rolling through here and trying to look here on some of the guys. And I was a big Drinkwitz guy. I'm glad to see him at App State, and that's going to be a tough act to follow at App State, you know, with Satterfield. But he's a guy I like what he does offensively. He's kind of doing some things that are a little bit divergent, in my opinion. Not just kind of following the crowd, you know, at chow time. And so I'm interested to see kind of what he can do. So, I mean, those are some names that without really kind of digging in that we're kind of paying attention to. Anybody on your radar that you're thinking of?
Numbers,
I'm trying to kind of.
I think Clark Lee at Notre Dame is just from knowing him and knowing the way his mind operates, he's going to be, you know, he's what you're talking about in terms of a figure outer. You know, he thinks big picture. You know, I'll be really interested in, you know, whether Grinch can, you know, I don't know the personality for Grinch. I feel like he's a little bit of a under the radar guy in terms of just. But if he can turn things around as a defensive coach at Oklahoma, I mean that'll say something.
No doubt.
I agree. I mean, Grinch did a phenomenal job at Washington State. I think it's going to be a really interesting. I mean, they certainly can get the talent there. I think Lincoln's going to play a key role. And does he right. allow Grinch? Is he gonna create an environment that allows defense to thrive?
And he might not.
He might not. He is Stephen Prather, Sports Source Analytics. You can check out all of their products at sportssourceanalytics.com. You can follow them on Twitter. Great nuggets always getting dropped on Twitter at Sports Source A, SportSource. Stephen, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. Really appreciate it. Always good to come on.